Guys, I'm going to dive right in. Here's the question that we've been asking, as Jamie said. Who do you think Jesus is? And one of the top responses we got was this one. Why should I even care? I'm not sure if you got that response. I did with one bloke I asked. I said to him, mate, who do you think Jesus is? And he said, dunno. And he said, well, to tell you the truth, mate, and no offence, because he kind of knows the kind of things I'm involved in here. He said, no offence, but don't really think about the whole God thing very much at all. Not really that interested. Which is effectively to kind of say, mate, I don't know why you asked me the question. I don't really care. I don't know if you got that kind of answer, but it was actually one of the top responses we got to this question. Who do you think Jesus is? Apparently, and I believe it, a good stack of the people on the Central Coast don't really care, to put it nicely, don't really know why they should be caring. Now, you know, that kind of came out with what Tanya was sharing a little bit, you know, a couple of years back, you know, knew there was something missing, but life's going okay, just get about life. Why do we need to care about God and about Jesus? And I actually think the vast majority of people around us, and particularly those who are thinking this way, they're not necessarily antagonistic towards God or Jesus or the church. It's not like they're waving their angry fists at God. They're just busy with life. Yeah. Just busy pursuing life, going after whatever the good life is that they think is that, whether that be, you know, trying to be successful at work or trying to do well at school or uni or just trying to build a fantastic family, keep that afloat, trying to keep hanging out with your friends on the weekend, try to live the healthy, fun weekend lifestyle, or try to live the kind of ultimate cruisy, relaxing lifestyle. Everyone's got their thing that they're trying to do with their life, and most people are kind of busy and caught up doing their thing. And so it's actually quite easy to be just doing that and not really thinking much about God or Jesus, which is to ignore the whole Jesus thing. It's to think, well, he's probably up there somewhere, but I'll leave him to his things and I'll just go about my things and I'm sure he'll understand. It's not like I'm running around murdering anyone. You know, I'm trying to do the best with my life and make the most of life. And when you put it like that, it kind of sounds innocent enough, doesn't it? It sounds like, yeah, I mean, you tell me. Some of you are here tonight and you might be honest enough to think, yeah, that's where I'm at. That's what I'm thinking. Someone dragged me along or I'm kind of here, but I don't really care too much about it. Why should I? It sounds innocent enough. It almost sounds like a bit of a safe option, really, to just kind of get about your life. Doesn't sound like you'll be offending anyone. You're not going to be some crazy extremist. But here's what I want to suggest. That actually, to be thinking like that and living like that, you could not make a more serious mistake with your life than to think like that and live like that. Let me suggest it's like this. Ignoring God is actually the last thing you want to do with your life. It's not a safe option at all. There are some things in life, there are some issues in life that if you just ignore them, they'll go away. God is not one of those. But there are some of those kind of issues. Like an example might be like an annoying puppy, yeah, that just keeps wanting to jump up at you and lick you or bite you, or a cat. Cats are super annoying. But you got to, say you got to, just had to throw cats in there. How's cats? What's with them? Anyway, you've got this annoying puppy. Now, it's actually pretty good, easy to get rid of puppies, really. You just ignore them. You stand up, you cross your arms, you turn your back on them. That's a terrible thing to do to a puppy, isn't it? But if you just do that, eventually the thing's going to go away, you know. There's some issues in life that if you just ignore them and keep ignoring them, they'll go away. God is not one of those issues. God's not one of those things. Now, let me attempt to convince you to care. Because some of you here tonight, you need convincing. You're on the edge of whether you come back again. You're on the edge of whether you want to borrow this or not. Many of you have got friends who need convincing. Let me attempt to convince you tonight. And the way I'm going to attempt to do that is first by acknowledging that I'm not the first person to attempt to convince someone that Jesus is real. In fact, for the last 2,000 years, followers of Jesus have been attempting to convince people to care about Jesus with significant success, I might add. hence the existence of the church and the growth of the church for the last 2,000 years. So what I want to do is I actually want to take you back in history. I actually want to take you back to a point in history in the first century to a man named Paul, a historical figure, who actually used to be a really aggressive opponent of all things to do with Jesus, but became a passionate believer. And I want to take you to one of the talks he does, one of the speeches he does, where he attempts to convince his audience to care about Jesus. And he actually does a pretty good job. There's a few people who at the end of it decide they want to follow Jesus. They want to care about Jesus. And so I'm trusting that maybe tonight, if we look at Paul's speech, that perhaps some of you will start to care more than you ever have. Perhaps care for the very first time. So come and have a look at Acts 17, the Bible passage that we had read. That's the speech, the talk that I'm talking about that Paul gives. It's on the handout that you've got there that Kate read for us, or it's in your Bible. And let me just give you a little bit of context. This bloke named Paul is a historical figure. He's actually one of the apostles of the early church. And he's walking around in a Greek city called Athens. And Athens back in that day was like the center for intellectual, philosophical thinking. And Paul's kind of moving his way to convince anyone who'll listen to consider and care about Jesus. So he's going to the religious types. He's walking into the Jewish temples, the synagogues, and he's trying to talk to them about Jesus. He's out in the marketplace just trying to talk to anyone who's walking past to consider Jesus. And actually, it's when he's out in the marketplace that some of the leading thinkers of the city actually hear him and decide they want to hear a little bit more in a formal sense. So they invite him to come to a place called the Areopagus, which is basically just the place where all the leading thinkers of the city would gather to formally consider a new idea they hadn't heard of before. And they'd usually come to some kind of a judgment over that idea. So it's almost like a public forum or a courtroom for ideas. They didn't have the web back then, so they didn't have blogs, so you could put your crazy ideas out there and have other people criticize them. Or they didn't have the media where you could have a show, perhaps like a Q&A kind of thing where someone can suggest ideas and it can be debated. They had the Areopagus. That's where you went to share your ideas, and that's where people got to ask you questions. Paul gets invited to go to that place. He stands up in the public place and he addresses the crowd. And what he says previous to this speech is simply this. He stands up and he starts by affirming them. He starts by telling them about something that he actually likes that he sees in them. You see, they're a city with thousands of gods. If you're Greek, you worship as many gods as you possibly can. You're a polytheist, yeah? And so Paul's been walking around the city and he sees thousands of idols to thousands of different gods. And the first thing he does, though that distresses him, he wants to acknowledge something good that he sees in that. He acknowledges and he says, well, you're a very religious people. You are keen to worship other gods or other things outside of yourself. And just to start with, I kind of want to say that's a good thing. It's a good thing to want to worship beyond yourself. You're not the center of the universe. It's good that they're doing that. But then Paul notes something that he spotted on one of the particular idols as he's walked around the city, which has got an inscription that says, to an unknown God. And Paul picks up on that and he says to them basically, by your own admission, there's a God that you do not know, and this is the God I want to talk to you about. It's true. There's a God you don't know about. There's a God that you don't care about. This is the God I want to speak to you about and I want to call you to care about. How does he do that? How does he actually try to call this crowd to care about Jesus? Well, what he doesn't do is he doesn't actually say things like this. He doesn't say, I highly recommend Jesus. You know, he's really great. And you really should consider caring a bit about him along with all the other things you care about in your life because he's fantastic. Now, Paul just basically puts it like this. He says, you must care about Jesus. You are responsible to care. And one day you will be held accountable for whether you did care or not. Just puts it out there. Now, on what basis could that be said? On what basis does Paul say these things? I want you to look at his reasoning for how he could get away with saying that. And he basically does this. He gives them one or two big things and then a whole bunch of implications that hang off those big things. The big things he starts off by giving them is this. There is a God. He's the one who made everything. And he did it very carefully and deliberately. And then he rolls off all these implications that come from that. So come and have a look at it there with me. Pick it up there in verse 24 and see what Paul starts off by saying. We'll read verse 24 and 25. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth, and he does not live in temples built by human hands, and he is not served by human hands as if he needed anything. Rather, he himself gives everyone life and breath and everything else. Paul basically starts by saying this: I want to tell you about a God, but he's the God who made everything. He's not one among many gods. He's the God that I'm talking about here. He exists, and he's the great giver of all life. He's the one who actually made all things, including you. He's real. He's existed for a long time before anything ever did. In fact, everything that does exist came from him, because he's the author of all life. He's the designer of all life. He is the creator. He's the one from whom everything flows. Everything's come from him. He's the one who gives life. He gives breath. He gives everything else. What Paul's trying to say here is, he's trying to say, if there is something that you can see that exists, it came from God. Now, that's a pretty big claim, but that's what he starts with. And then he moves on to a bit of a connection to that. If there is a God who exists and he really did made everything else, then Paul says he's the one who's the Lord. He's Lord over heaven and earth. You see that? The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth. And can you see the logic between those two things? If God is the one who made all things, then all things belong to him. See the connection? It's a pretty simple one. God's the one who owns everything. Everything that exists actually belongs to God. The giver of life is the Lord of life. He's the master, he's the boss, he's the king. Got that? That's how Paul starts. Now, that's a controversial thing to say these days. It was a controversial thing to say back in Athens in that day, where they believed in many gods. God said, no, there's one God. He made everything and he rules over everything. And then Paul gives the implications of that. What does that mean for us if it's true? If it's true that there is a God who rules over everything, then here are the implications. And it's important for us to acknowledge these implications, consider these implications, because they are what naturally flows from that statement that there is a God who made everything. Here's one implication. First one's this: if there is a God who made everything and he owns everything, then you live in his world. Got that one? You breathe his air, you eat his food, you use his stuff. All the things that you have that you think are yours actually belong to him, because he owns all things. We talk about my money, my possessions, my car, my house, my things, my family. But if it's true that God made everything and owns everything, then really all those things are generous gifts to you from God, entrusted to you for a season, before you leave them behind. That's an obvious implication that comes from the fact that God is the maker of all things, yeah? And here's one that's kind of in addition to that, similar to that. If God made all things and rules over all things, then even your life, even your very existence that's personal to you, is a gift from him. His life has been extended to you because he's the one who is life and gives it. He gave you life, he sustains your life, and when he decides, it will be over. But again, we talk about my life, don't we? This is mine. But you know what? This one that you've got is actually his, given to you. You owe your very existence to him. The health that you might experience from time to time, the skills that you might have, the abilities that you might have, especially those natural things that have just come to you easily, the opportunities you've had right throughout your life, all that, it's all generous gifts from God. That's just the implications that kind of run naturally from the fact that there is a God who made everything and owns everything, yeah? Now, just on the way through, consider this with me. If that's true, if what we've just seen there is true, then just on a really reasonable level, To go through life ignoring God is to actually ignore the one who gave you life. It's actually just to ignore the one, it's actually to turn away from the one who is the source of life. It's to effectively cut yourself off from life itself. And when you put it like that, that sounds pretty foolish. Yeah? It's like an astronaut who decides, I'm off. And they jump out of the space station. Is that what they live in? Up. They jump off the... And they've got the... What do you... The air cable. I'm just getting all technical here on you, right? Now, how wise would it be to just jump off and go, yep, cut it on the way. I'll be right, I'm off. No, no, no. This cable is a cable to the life source, the thing that's going to keep them alive, to kind of drift off and ignore where life comes from, the thing that's going to keep you alive. It's just foolishness, isn't it? You might have seen Gravity, yeah, with Sandra Bullock and George Clooney. If you haven't, let me ruin it for you, right? He, I can't even remember how it happens, but at some stage George Clooney's just kind of, he's drifting, but he's still attached, and then there's some kind of decision that needs to make, and he gets set free, and it's really dramatic and scary and sad, but off he goes. He drifts off, and he's gone. And I've ruined it for you completely, but I'm telling you, she thinks he comes back, but it's just a dream, all right? I know, I've started, I'm going to ruin it all right? The point is this, it's just foolishness in the extreme to cut the cord, cut yourself off from the source of life. If God is the source of life, it makes no sense to ignore him and cut yourself off from him, if you put it like that. Now, Paul gives us more. He doesn't just tell us that God is the source of life. He actually goes on. He gives us another implication. If he is the one who gives life and he rules over all life, then here's another kind of implication that we need to acknowledge. It's this, that we are dependent beings. We're not autonomous, self-sustaining beings. We like to think we are. And the problem with wealth, and we're wealthy compared to other parts of the world. The problem with wealth is it does give us a sense of control and a sense of power and a sense of independence, but the problem is it's a false sense of security, because the truth is our lives are actually highly reliant on many things that are beyond our control. Life is actually quite fragile, and occasionally life humbles us and we're forced to acknowledge that truth and we're reminded about that, and it's not pleasant. But the truth is, we are at the mercy of many things that are beyond our control. Paul wants to stress that God is different from that. He is not like us in that way. He is not dependent on anyone or anything like we are. He is not a dependent being in any way. He is truly independent. He is truly self-sustaining. He has life in himself, and he can create life where there is nothing previously. We're not like that. We simply fabricate things from things that already exist, whereas God can call something into being when there was nothing there previously. And so Paul wants to make the point that it's ridiculous to suggest that God needs anything from us. Have a look at how he does it, verse 24, halfway through verse 24. I'll read from the beginning. God, who made the world and everything in it, is the Lord of heaven and earth, and he does not live in temples built by hands. Yeah? It's ridiculous to suggest that God lives in a place that he needs us to build for him and provide for him food and shelter. Look down in verse 29, it says a similar thing. Therefore, since we are God's offspring, we should not think the divine being is like silver or gold or stone, an image made by human design or skill. It's actually an insult to the God who made everything and rules over everything to think that we can make an image of him out of gold and silver using our hands. God actually gave a really explicit command about that. He said, don't ever try to do that. Don't even attempt to make an image of me. You don't make me. I make you. I extend my life to you. Don't try and make an image of me. You won't ever come close. You're the dependent beings. I am the truly independent one. Now, that's a humbling thing to swallow, but it is what naturally flows as an implication if it's true that God is the one who makes all life and owns all life. These are the implications. And they're humbling, but they're worth considering. Now, Paul not only tells us that God is the one who makes everything and rules over everything, Paul actually gives us detail on how God made things. And that's really helpful to look at how he made it, because it points us to some really good implications. God actually makes things carefully, in an orderly way. He designs it, he plans it. And particularly considering humanity, what can be said is this. If this is true, then our life and all of life is not simply a result of random physical and chemical processes. No, there's an author, there's a designer of all this. But nor did that designer or author, that God, simply kind of just kind of chuck it all out there, throw it all together, make a big blob of humans, put them on a globe, give it a spin, and then just kind of see how it goes. No. We have a designer who actually carefully plans and purposes the details of life, and particularly humanity. Have a look at how Paul describes it, verse 26. From one man he made all the nations, that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he marked out their appointed times in history and the boundaries of that land. That's saying this about God. Here's how he did it. He starts with one man, and from that one man he brings all the nations of the world and actually causes them to inhabit the whole of the earth. That's how God does it, in that order, in that way, so we all get traced back to one man. How did that happen? How did that one man do that? Was he a hermaphrodite and just was able to kind of multiply himself? No. God takes that man and from the man makes another being just like him, but just heaps better. He makes a woman. It's a phenomenally good thing. And then he brings the woman to the man, and right there you see the first wedding, the first marriage, God's design. And from them come the first family. And God institutes how humanity will grow in that fashion. And he's wise and he knows what he's doing, and we ought not mess with it. I'll throw that one out there. Get a bit controversial, right? God's good and has careful development for humanity. It's not just uncontrolled sprawling of humanity. Look what he says there. He says, he marks out their appointed times in history and the boundaries of their lands, which is to say this, God actually determines and appoints the exact times in history when certain people would exist and the exact place on the earth where they would live. That's how detailed God got and continues to be. God actually carefully positions people in space and time according to his plan and his purpose. God ordains it all. He weaves it all together. You look back in history and you see people groups appear and then disappear. You see people groups come and move in one place and then move to another. God is over all of that. You see superpowers rise up and then fall again, as we will see in our day. God ordains it all, including you and your life. And here's the big implication for us to consider. If it's true that God is the one who carefully designs and places all people, then here's the implication for you and I. You are not an accident. It may be that your parents have told you that, you know. They've said you weren't planned. But I've got news for you. You are not here by accident. God put you here in this moment in time, this moment in history, in this very place. God orchestrated your existence. He intended for you to be alive right now. You exist by God's careful design and intent. And if that's true, that does lead you to ask one whopping big question, doesn't it? If there is an author of life and he does things in a very detailed, planned, orderly way and puts you here at this point in time, it does cause you to ask one question, doesn't it? The big question. Why? Why? If God would go to all that trouble to do things in such a special way, a careful way, a spectacular way, why? Is that not the big question that arises when you consider a God who's done things like this? Why? Give us the purpose. Why are we here? Why have you put us here the way you've put us here? Verse 27. Paul says the answer. God did this so they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from any of us. You got it? Life is given by God so that we might seek him, reach out for him, and find him. Which is to say, the very purpose of your existence is to know him. That's why you're here. That's why he's done everything he's done to place you here, is so that you would know him and have a relationship with him. God creates in such a special way, carefully ordered, beautifully, and we are meant to look at life and go hunting for the maker, the designer, the creator. You exist to know your God. And if that is the case, then it's no surprise at all that God has made himself easy to find. As it says there, he is not far from any of us. Which is to say, actually there's no excuse to not know him. You ought to be able to look at life around you. You ought to be able to look at creation and see that it displays God's power and divine nature, Romans 1. You ought to be able to look at the skies and see that they proclaim his awesomeness, Psalm 8. You ought to be able to look at life around you and see that there is a God. You ought to be able to look at life in you and see that there is a God and know that God. Verse 28, what does it say there? For in him we live and move and have our being. We are his offspring, as some of your own poets have said. Paul actually quotes the poets who are acknowledging that we are the offspring of God. He uses their language, which is to say this, that you ought to sense God's life in you. It may be diminished and it may be clouded, but there ought to be an internal witness in you that just testifies to the core of your being that his life is in us, that we must have come from him, so he therefore must be real and he must be knowable. If I exist, he must exist. It's like a kid who says, if I'm here, I must have a dad. Even if I've never met him, even if people tell me he doesn't exist, there must be a dad because I'm here. We exist, there is a God. We're basically to look no further than our own existence to be able to see him and know him. So why doesn't that work for everyone? Why isn't it that everyone around just looks around and comes to the conclusion that there is a God and he's good and that he made us and that he loves us? Well, we've got an issue. We've got an issue that's a problem in humanity, and we've all got it. And it means we've got a tendency to ignore him, a tendency to just get on with life and pretend like he doesn't exist. We've just got a tendency to be too busy for him to know him. The Bible calls that tendency sin. At the very heart of sin is just this thing in us that just wants to ignore him. So what that means is, as we look at life around us and as we look at life in us, often people don't come to the conclusion that there is a God. We need more. And the good news is God has done more. Though he is near to all of us, he's come even closer. Because looking at creation and look at yourself will only get you so far, and we're so good at ignoring. Here's what God does. He not only is not far from us, he also comes near to us. And he comes near to us in a spectacular way. Instead of us just being left to seek him, reach out for him, find him, he comes to seek us out, to reach out to us and find us, because we need him to do that. And he does that so that we might truly know him. Not simply know that he exists and know something about him, but actually genuinely know him in a personal way. And really, true knowledge of a person is to have a relationship with them, yeah? To truly know God is to be in relationship with him. And the way God makes that possible is by coming to us in the person of Jesus and making the way clear, removing the obstacle, giving us a way to kind of get rid of that ignorance of God, and giving us a way to him. God comes and enters into human history. Friends, he's made himself easy to find, because he's made us to know him. We're meant to see him in the life around us. We're meant to see him in the life in us. But ultimately and most clearly, we're meant to see him in the historical figure of Jesus, who the Bible says is God the Son, come to us as a man. Hebrews 1 actually tells us that he's the radiance of God's glory. Jesus is the exact representation of his being. So you want to know what God is like? Jesus came and walked the earth. He lived among us in a remarkable way. He died a horrific death, but then rose again from the dead, claiming to provide a way back to God. God didn't just come down and walk around and kind of go, hey, here I am, this is what I'm like. No, he came here to kind of fix the issue and deal with sin. And Paul here, and what we're doing here is we're wanting to proclaim Jesus and caring about Jesus, because Jesus is the way God has come to us to make himself known to us so that we can know him and be in relationship with him. Friends, God has done all this. God has done everything so that you and I would know him. And if it's true that this is what he's done, then responsibility now lies with us. The ball is in our court. He has done all that is needed to make himself known to us. It's now up to you. It's now up to me. Now you tell me, if this is true what God has done, then just thinking about this on a reasonable level, is it okay for a person to go on in life ignoring the one who gave them life? Is it okay for a person to live life too busy for the one who is the source of life? Is it just simply innocence to take the life that he gives and live it without regard to him? No, it's not. It's actually a great insult to God. He takes it very personally. We are actually culpable. We have failed in our responsibility if we do not know the one who has given us life. You might expect that God would take offense to ignorance, and he does, because we're responsible to know him. Have a look at where the responsibility kind of jumps out of this passage there. Look at verse 30. In the past, God has overlooked such ignorance, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent. For he has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed. He has given us proof of this to everyone. He has given proof of this to everyone by raising him from the dead. Here's the call, people. If it's true that God has done all this, then here's the call from God. He commands all people everywhere. And on behalf of God, I would like to call you and command you on his behalf, repent. Which sounds kind of big and scary, but repent just means turn. Turn away from continuing to ignore him and turn to him. Come to know him. God commands you and calls you to turn and actually seek him, reach out for him, find him. God will not overlook ignorance. He won't overlook it. He'll actually hold you accountable for whether you have known him. He has been, through time, patiently giving you time to come to know him. He's done everything to testify to you about his goodness. The ball is in your court. Know him. Today is your opportunity to harmonize with reality. Today is your opportunity to get right side up and come to know the God that gave you life. And it's pretty urgent to get it done, because God has set a day when he will judge us according to whether we have come to know him or not. Verse 31, he set a day where he will judge with justice, and it's fair and right for him to judge in this way. He's being just as he does it. The judge is who? The man. We're all going to stand before the man, the man, the one who is risen from the dead. That's Jesus on the final day. And we will be held accountable for the life that we've been given. The big thing we'll be held accountable for is whether you've sought him, reached out to him, and found him. through Jesus. How do we know for sure this day is coming? How do we know this isn't just scare tactics to try and get people to be nice? Well, Paul says, the proof that this day is coming, the proof that God will judge by Jesus is in Jesus' own resurrection. And Paul actually just mentions it like it is a historic event that there is evidence for. And if you're someone who's just thinking, really? Jesus rose from the dead? This is very key to Christianity. There must be evidence to support it. And there is, the stacks. We're going to look at some more next week. But if you want to look at heaps of evidence for the resurrection, come and do the Life series. Because the heart of Christianity hangs off this concept of Jesus being raised from the dead. And therefore we know the day is coming where we will stand before him and be judged. How does that logic work? How does the logic work that just because Jesus rose again from the dead, we will stand before him and be judged? Here's how it works. If Jesus was raised from the dead, he did come back to life after he died, then there is life after death for all of humanity. Because he was truly human and truly God at the same time. If he came back, there is life beyond this one. And he says there is. Secondly, if Jesus came back from the dead and he was powerfully raised, exalted, glorified as Lord over all things, then that is him being appointed as the judge who will judge with authority over all of humanity. So who is Jesus? Why should you even care about Jesus? You were made to know your God. He's done everything possible to make himself knowable to you, particularly by coming in the person of Jesus. You are responsible to know him, and you will be held accountable for it because it is the very purpose of your existence. Accountability for us will come one day soon on that day where we stand before Jesus. That's the reason why you need to care about Jesus, because you're going to meet him. Possibly one day soon. And all that's going to matter is whether you've come to know God through him. That's the purpose of your existence, to know God through Jesus. So there's Paul's argument. There's one of many types of arguments that can be made for why a person should care about Jesus. And I'm going to anticipate that there's going to be three types of responses to this. Just like there was three types of responses to Paul when he first gave it out. You'll notice there's three types of people. Firstly, there's the kind of person who sneers at this. We don't use that word too often these days, sneering. But you might be sitting there feeling like you're sneering right now. I think that's kind of like scoffing. Or just thinking, this is all just a big fat joke. I'm out of here. I'm going to continue to expect that there will be many who consider these things and go, nah, I don't want a bar of it. I hope that's not you. I pray that you're not someone who is happy to go on ignoring anymore. Worst mistake you can make. Don't do it. Don't do it. There might be some of you in that second category of people. Some people came to Paul and they said, we want to hear more about this. We want to hear more from you on this topic. I trust there might be some of you here thinking, I've got to look into this some more. I need to look at the details more. I need to look at the evidence more. Friends, that is very much why we exist, to give many an opportunity to consider Jesus and look into the details, look at the evidence, make up your mind, considering things seriously. And there's many ways to do this. Just keep coming back to church. Keep talking to everyone who's around you. Keep asking all the questions you have. Get along to life. Get along to whatever you can. But whatever you do, know that this is the big one to sort out in life. To understand why you need to care about Jesus and to come to know your God through him. But I want to anticipate also there might be some of you in that third category who even tonight might think, it's time. It's time for me to just believe in this. It's time for me to put my trust in this God. I do believe he made me. I do believe he carefully appointed me to be here in this point in time. I do believe he did all that so that I would know him. I've been stubborn, I've been ignoring him, but that time is up and I've got to turn to him now. I don't want to run away anymore. I don't want to pretend he doesn't exist. I see that I need to turn to him. And if that's you tonight, do it tonight. You don't need to wait for some special moment. Just do it on your own after church. Just pray. Or pray with the person who brought you here. Or come and talk to me. I'd love to pray with you. But whatever you do, it may very well be that tonight is the night you need to make this decision. You've seen enough evidence. There's been enough internal evidence. You need to make the call. Do it tonight. Do it now. And just like Dionysius, Damaris, and a whole bunch of others who, after they heard Paul present this argument, said, yeah, it's time. I've got to know this God. You can come to know him and have relationship with him and do the very thing that you were put here to do. Let me pray. Father God, we're grateful to you for how you have revealed yourself to us, by the way you've made the world, by the way you've made us, by the way you've come to us in the person of Jesus. You've done everything that's needed. Lord, would you help us to see you and know you and find you in Jesus? And would you help some to even do that tonight? Amen.